I am so thrilled today to welcome Dave
Schweidenbach.
Sorry, David Schweidenbach from Pedals for Progress to the show. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
All right, can you give us a brief overview of what does Pedals for Progress do?
Pedals for Progress collects used bicycles and used sewing machines from people in the greater Northeast, and we accept those as charitable donations, and we use that material as economic development aid in developing world countries.
It's brilliant because it's a hand up, not a handout, right? There's so many aspects of this that I want to get into, because these are the bikes and the sewing machines. But can you tell us, how did it all come to be? How did Pedals for Progress start?
In the late 70s, I was a Peace Corps volunteer in Ecuador. And I lived at the end of the road going out into the Amazon basin. And other than a bus that came through town twice a day, everybody walked everywhere they went all the time. And
they're probably in good shape, right?
Yeah, they had nice legs. But it just slowed down everything so much, because it took an hour to walk to my office, an hour to walk home, a half hour to walk to the market. It just took so slow. And everybody in town dealt with that except for my landlord. My landlord, Cesar Pena, had the only bicycle in town. And I was always amazed at how productive he was, that people hired him. He was a carpenter. He was missing three fingers and one eye.
Wow.
And he would get on his bike every day. He had a great work ethic. And he would pedal off with his hammer and his nails and his handsaw. And he would work all over the county because he could get there. The other carpenters with their tools could only walk 1 or 2 miles either side of their house and still have a day's work.
Mm.
Cesar could go 10 miles. So he was one of the, in their terms, well-off families.
Mm-hmm.
You wouldn't think of him as well-off in our society. But it was because he had a great work ethic. And he was introduced to mankind's greatest invention, the wheel.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. Well, is that how he lost his eye? It must have been tricky balancing all those sharp tools on the bike.
Right? No, I think it was just cutting him off on his own. But I never saw anybody ride so slow on a bike. That bike moved at like half of 1 mile an hour.
Well, it was still more productive than walking, right?
But it was more productive than walking, yes.
Oh, my gosh, that's great. So that was the Peace Corps. But then that was the 70s, and you didn't start Pedals for Progress till what, 20 years later or 15 years later?
Yeah, I came home. I got married. I had some kids.
Mm-hmm.
We were living in Long Island, which was just too crowded for me.
Mm-hmm.
And we followed every train line out of New York City for a two-hour commute, because my wife works in the city. And one of the lines we came out was the Raritan Valley line. We camped at Spruce Run Reservoir, and we drove around, and we said, wow, this would be a great place to raise our kids. So we moved out here, and I was a general contractor. I did pretty well, and I got to the point that I was pretty successful, and I wanted to give back a little. And every week I would see bicycles by the garbage can, good bikes for no reason. So I decided I wanted to collect 12 bicycles on my own dime and ship them back to Sakua in Ecuador and have them distributed so some of the people I knew could have that same ability to get to work on time. And it just took off from there.
That's great. And because how many did you get?
Well, I walked into the Hunterdon Review, and I asked the editor to put me on the front page. I told him what I wanted to do. He told me I was absolutely crazy. He said, you're going to get so many bikes, they're going to cover your house. I went, no, I'll be lucky to get a dozen. I got 12 dozen.
Awesome. That's a good kind of crazy, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
So then my next step was to go into the Ecuadorian consulate in Newark and get the import permits. So I walked in. I made an appointment. I went in, I got the consular general, I sat down, I told him my whole story and what I was trying to do is to create employment, to give people the ability to make more money, because people aren't unemployed, they're underemployed.
Okay.
And he listened to me very carefully, listened to my whole story, and said, no.
That's government for you, right?
Well, he got out. He lived in the United States. Life was good.
Yeah.
And I started this whole organization with the idea of shipping bikes to Ecuador, which has basically never happened. They just have never let me in. So then I left the office in Newark, and I had to go home and tell my wife, who had 144 bikes in her backyard that they said no. And then I was really reeling, like, oh, what do I do now? And at that time, we were really nearing the end of the wars all through Central America. And there were a lot of groups that were sending aid down to Nicaragua. And mainly they were sending rice and beans, medical supplies. Mm-hmm. Just, you know, the country was just torn apart.
Yeah.
Civil war is a very ugly thing.
Yeah.
And I contacted one of these groups, and I asked them if they would consider sending some bikes. So they said, okay, we'll give it a try. They put 50 bikes in one container. It went down. The people were ecstatic. They were like, we want more, we want more, we want more. So I started putting 50 bikes in each container, and I started collecting. And I did that for a couple of years, and I was still working full time. And I realized that I had a tiger by the tail. There was potential here, that there seemed to be an unlimited number.
Absolutely.
So sat down with my wife at dinner one day and told her I wanted to quit my job and do this full time. To which her exact response is, you do remember you have two children. Excuse me. And she knew I had to give it a try. So she said she'd give me 1 year. But if I wasn't making money in a year, hey, you know, you have two children. And that year, the previous year, I had shipped 800 bikes. That year that I went full time, I shipped 2,400.
Wow, that's amazing.
And then the numbers have just been going up since then.
Right, because that was the first couple countries, and you've shipped to how many countries total?
37, 38, I stopped counting.
Well, I know, that is just incredible. And I love the whole story of doing good and helping others and the global concept, and people just need perspective or need to realize that how something so simple can transform a life and a community, right?
Let me give you one good anecdotal story. In Rivas, Nicaragua, my first big program, which I've been shipping there for 28 years now, I've shipped over 25,000 bikes into that town.
Amazing.
When I first started, the average kid completed fourth grade. Because by the time you're 10, they're subsistence farmers.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
And people live 3, 4, 5 miles from the school, so it took 1 to 2 hours to walk to school, 1 to 2 hours to get home. The parents wanted their kids educated, but by the time they're 10, did you milk the cow?
Yeah.
You know, have you picked the avocados?
Chores come first.
We have rice to bring in. This is a farming community.
Mm-hmm.
Today, 25,000 bikes later, the average kid completes high school because they can ride into school and ride back because school gets out at 1 o'clock and they still have time to do their chores.
It's critical, right? I do a lot of work with Room to Read, and that's the exact same story. The girls, when they get to secondary school, it's farther away and they don't have time to do all the chores and fetch the water. So Room to Read gives them a bike and then they can do both.
It's
transformational. It's amazing. So now that these communities are more educated, has there been a rise in
standard of living?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Our average adult recipient has a 15% increase in income the first day they get the bike.
Oh my gosh,
because
that's
they
incredible.
Save. So it's about time.
Exactly.
There's only so much time in a day that you can do stuff, and this is just an incredible labor saving device.
Yep, and that it's incredible. So how many bikes total have you shipped in the total?
About 154,000.
Oh my gosh, have you stopped counting that as well?
No, I'm still counting.
That's good. You should. Well, and the other thing is, people don't understand, because I used to collect books and they're like, oh yeah, just ship the books over there. I'm like, well, there's so many issues with that, but shipping is quite complicated, especially to those other countries. So
logistics,
that's amazing. So I think you posted your most recent shipment to Albania. You kind of chronicled the whole thing and the back and forth. And I mean, it's a nightmare, right?
We used a shipping line that I prefer not to use.
Oh, okay. So that was
the
difference.
When the ship got to Doris, the weather was bad, so they just didn't stop.
They
just went on to the next port.
Oh my gosh.
I try not to use that shipping line.
Okay.
But, the logistics can be a nightmare. I recently had a shipment to Uganda of sewing machines that was, quote, lost. for 3 months. Ugh. And I jumped up and down and screamed and yelled, and finally it was found.
Yeah,
because someone saw it and went, oh, I'd like that. And I don't know. I don't know how they lost it for 3 months, but it's finally found.
Well, you hear that. There's so much corruption. There's so much, you know, just bribing and this and that. So what does a good shipping experience look like at the companies that you do use? Is it fairly straightforward or no?
It depends on the country.
Okay.
It really, because the shipping isn't as complicated as getting into the country. You know, when you go with a 40-foot container or you ship 2 cubes of sewing machines that weigh 2,000 pounds, you can't sneak around. You got to go through the front door. And the front door is controlled by the government.
Mm-hmm.
And if you think about it, okay, we become the government of a small country. We need money. You want hospitals, I want a navy, I'm a sailor. Where are we going to get money? Well, we can't tax the poor, they don't have shoes. There is no middle class. And you and my family represent the upper class. Well, it's not going to be our money. So the only thing they can tax is imports.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, the head of customs is one of the most powerful people in every country because he's the guy that makes the money.
Oh, yeah. Well, we're getting a good lesson in economics here. This is amazing. And we're back with David Schweidenbach, did I say that better? Of Pedals for Progress, the founder of Pedals for Progress, an amazing organization that gives bikes and sewing machines to countries all over the world. Can you talk about the sewing machine aspect of it a little bit and how that got looped in with the bikes?
Well, I was always trying to find, I was always looking for diversity. I started in Nicaragua, and I realized, oh, wow, I have to be in multiple countries because you can't be so singular. And I tried a lot of different things. I tried computers. I tried sporting goods. I mean, but there were complications with all of them. And it was my son's idea. We had an old sewing machine, and it was like, well, what are we going to do with this? And my son's joke, he was, ship it to Nicaragua. That might not be a bad idea. So I shipped some down. Actually, I shipped the first sewing machines to Monte Cristi in the Dominican Republic. And I realized that the goal of Pedals for Progress is to help people have a better life. And the bicycles, giving them mobility, gets them to their job, gets them to school, makes them more productive. Well, a sewing machine is a job in a box.
Correct.
And bicycles are available. Obviously, I collect thousands every year. I've been doing it for 28 years. But so are sewing machines. And the good thing about sewing machines, everybody's grandmother sewed.
Yep, mine did.
A lot of people's mother sewed. People don't sew much anymore.
And they should.
They should, but it isn't something they do. But new sewing machines, unless you get very expensive European machines, they're all plastic inside. They're junk. But in 1950, every woman had a sewing machine. And in 1960, they did. And they were solid, stainless steel, last forever sewing machines.
The Singers, right?
Singers, Whites, Brothers. And no one is going to throw out their grandmother's beloved sewing machine. They're sitting in a closet.
I have one in the basement.
Yeah. And people don't really want them, but they can't throw them out because this was mom's favorite thing. And as soon as they can find a valid thing to do with it,
mm-hmm.
such as donate it to help someone overseas, they just flow in.
Mm.
So since 1999, I started in 1999 with sewing machines, and I started very slowly because I learned after that first experience with 144 bikes in the backyard to be careful what you ask for because someone may give it to you. So I started very slow, just collecting a few until I figured out the mechanisms of being able to move them because mm-hmm. I do ship them sometimes with the bikes, but I also make individual sewing machine shipments. They call LCL, less than a container. It's just a 4-foot pallet stacked with sewing machines.
Wow.
And I had to figure out all those pieces, how to make all those pieces work, and then I had to figure out the development of the programs overseas because it's very different from the development of a bicycle program. Mm-hmm. A lot of my bike programs don't want sewing machines. They're not into that.
Right, right.
And a lot of my sewing machine programs don't want bikes. Mm-hmm. They're not into that. It's kind of a different thing.
Yeah.
And we had really hit a glass ceiling. We had hit a glass ceiling about 300 machines per year. And I couldn't get through it. And I kept trying to go to get speaking engagements with women's clubs and quilting clubs. And I would write them a letter that, you know, Dave from Petals for Progress wants to come speak to you. And the quilting club would look at it and go, I got no interest in this. And I realized that the problem was the name.
Mm-hmm.
Petals for Progress is a wonderful name. It in three words, it says everything that we do.
Brilliant.
But it was terrible for sewing machines.
Mm-hmm.
So we coined the name Sewing Peace.
Oh, yes. That's great.
And we had
connection with the Peace Corps, right?
And we had to, you know, register it with the government and, you know, all that stuff to make it our legal name also. So we're AKA Sewing Peace.
Okay.
And Sewing Peace describes what we do with sewing machines. And as soon as we did that, I broke through the glass ceiling and I went from 285 the year before to 555.
Oh my gosh.
Last year. And this year, I think I'm going to ship over 700.
Oh, that's incredible.
It's all in a name.
It is. It definitely is. And your heart's in the right place, and you're doing it smart and right. And I think that's amazing. I do think sewing is a lost art. I'd say bring back home ec, because it's a practical, tangible skill that's useful. I actually got a sewing machine because I wanted to make, when my kids were little, I wanted to make those cute little diapers with ribbons just run down the side. So it was just sewing a straight line, so it didn't create, and you know, it wasn't too tough. But sewing is hard. The patterns and all that stuff is crazy. But I think a lot of them are making bags and purses, and they have help designing those and things at some of the places.
Well, if you think about the things you buy versus what your grandmother bought, when I first got married, my wife made curtains.
Aww.
She doesn't make curtains anymore. She goes to curtains.com. And if you want to buy a suit, you go in or you want to buy a shirt and pants, you go into Flemington Department Store and you can buy a pair of pants.
Mm-hmm.
In the developing world, when you want clothes made, someone has to make it for you.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the big industries in all these towns are school uniforms.
Oh.
All over the developing world, if you don't have the right color shirt, you're not going to school.
Yeah.
Like this shirt, everybody has a brown shirt or everybody has a blue shirt, and you have to have that exact color. So there's a huge employment possibility for making school uniforms, for making tablecloths,
mm-hmm.
for making curtains.
Mm.
And in the developing world, those jobs are still there,
mm-hmm.
and they're good middle-class, well-paying jobs.
Right. Right. And what is the deal with the uniforms? Is it kind of a status symbol, or it shows that you can afford to go to school, or it's just they want everybody to look the same? What's the cultural? I mean, I know we have school uniforms in some of the private schools here and different things, but those are more lax these days. But what's the cultural?
I think it's just so they can identify everybody that they're part of that school. But
okay.
it's a common thread
mm-hmm.
all the way across. And I know certainly the parochial schools, when I was a kid, had uniforms. And I remember I was on the Board of Education in Highbridge, and we put it up for a vote. I lost. that it, you know, it makes all the kids the same versus the kid that has that incredibly expensive clothing versus a poor kid who you know doesn't have that clothing. It uniforms, it makes the school work a little better when everybody's dressed the same.
Yeah, no, I mean, I do get that because I think the same in Asia. They have but it's also, I think, a status symbol, like I can afford to go to school and I wear this uniform. I think it depends. Like, I'm sure Central America is different from some of the Asian cultures and that. But, I mean, no, I think, you know, school uniforms are definitely definitely prevalent in a lot of those countries. And even and the ones here, they wear khaki. It's more simple, khakis and a polo and stuff like that. But uniforms still exist here.
But, yeah, you have to pay to go to school.
Yeah. Oh, and people don't realize that, I think, that you have to pay to go to school. It's not a free public education system at all.
No, not at all.
Yeah. And, well, and I was talking to you a little bit about my cousins were in the Peace Corps in Guatemala and met, and they tell me today how wacky the fees are. They'll say, okay, now you need to bring in $5 for construction paper fees, and it's all random. And then they have to, it's an extra hardship because they have to go out to town to the store to get it and take the bus. And it's not just picking up, you know, some markers at Rite Aid or something. You know, it's definitely, it's a whole different ballgame.
Yeah, often in some of these towns, you know who the teacher is because the teacher has the book, and no, you can't touch it. And she reads from the book
mm-hmm.
in the schoolroom.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and the kids are lucky if they have a slate and some chalk or, you know, pencils and pens and stuff like that are really expensive for people there. If you only make $1,000 a year, as a family. And you can live pretty well. You can afford rice and beans and the food you need, and maybe a little bit for the school. But if you only make $1,000 a year, I mean, if you have to have 7 days of antibiotic, that can wipe out your year's salary.
Absolutely.
You know, so things that are manufactured outside the country, anything that's imported is extremely expensive. Mm-hmm. So why Pedals for Progress worked? Businessmen are in business to make money.
Fair enough.
Businessmen in the developing world never imported bikes because the head of customs looked at bicycles and said, this is a toy for the rich, and put a huge import tax on it. So no businessmen ever imported bikes to sell them because the import tax was so high that they would have to sell them so high no one could afford to buy them.
Okay.
When I first started in Barbados, I put 4% of the country of Barbados on a bike. When I first started in Barbados, there was one bike shop, and the cheapest bike was $1,000. And there's a lot of poor people in Barbados. So I started importing bikes into Barbados, and we were selling them for $10 or $15 a piece to cover the shipping. And I got a phone call from the prime minister who wanted me the next day in his office because the one bike shop complained I was unduly competing. And I tried to explain to the prime minister that he can still sell his $1,000 bike, and any rich Brit is going to buy that. But for the poor Bajans, they can never afford that. And that the more you can mobilize your population, the quicker you can grow your gross domestic national product, and that mobility is a key to success. Mm-hmm. I mean, what has made America great in part were our railroads and our highways and our bus routes and giving the people the mobility to get their stuff done, and that just doesn't exist in the developing world.
So you spoke his language and then he got it?
Well, he spoke English.
Well, no, I meant like his language of economics.
Economic
growth.
Because I've always approached this as economic development. This is the idea is to create a more vibrant economic system. We live on a little rock in the middle of space. We're not moving anywhere soon. And our most immediate neighbors are the Tanzanians, the Somalis, the Guatemalans, the Argentine. These are our neighbors. When you live in a neighborhood, it is in your own self-interest that if one of your neighbors is struggling, that you help out. I'm not saying you're responsible for your neighbor. I don't believe that. But I believe if it's no skin off your nose and your neighbor's struggling, you should go help. Well, our most immediate neighbors are really struggling in these countries. And it's in our best interest that they become successful. And we can literally feed the world. Us in Canada, we can feed the whole world. We grow that much food. But we can't support the world. And one of the sad facts of adulthood, you got to go to work. That's how it works. You got to go to work. But if you can't get there, you can't work. And that's the problem in the developing world is underemployment. So by getting these people bicycles, these are the most ambitious people in the world because they're struggling. They will work. And when they get the ability to work, they go to work, they earn more money, and their society progresses. And it's in our interest that their society progresses. And the 154,000 bikes, the 4,000 sewing machines that I've collected would all be sitting in a landfill if I hadn't collected them. So I'm not taking anything away from anyone here. I'm actually solving a solid waste problem.
A bunch of problems. You're solving a lot of problems.
And then I take that and I do the work overseas. And another important part of my program is that I feel a lot of youth in this country have no conception of how lucky they are.
Right on.
And whenever we do collections, we always have a bunch of kids there that come in because they want to see what's going on, and they work for the day processing the bikes and sewing machines and getting them ready for shipment. And then at the end of the day, it kind of scratches the old brain cell saying, why did I do this? Why do these people need that? And it brings the plight of the developing world into the hearts of the kids here that they can now realize how lucky they are. Because you get a lot of dissatisfied kids because they don't have the newest $200 Michael Jordan sneakers. The world's going to end.
It's Steph Curry now. Now it's Steph Curry.
Okay.
but we know what you mean.
Don't follow basketball.
I know.
But they feel so distraught that they think things are so hard. But then when they take a look at who we're helping and how they live, the kids here get a much better appreciation of how lucky they are.
I know. You're going to make me cry because this is just right in my zone. I mean, I definitely, you know, I think kids need to get involved from a young age. It seems to be a family value. It needs to be, you need to do it. You need to get out there. And that's why I think your model is so perfect and so important because people can relate to a bicycle. And the other thing is you're not just giving a handout. Yes, you're shipping bikes and you're shipping sewing machines, but you also have a whole training program around that, right, of maintaining the bikes and repairing the bikes. And people are required to work in the shops before they get a bike, right?
Well, either work in the shop or they have to buy it. I do not believe in giving things away. We don't give anything away.
Absolutely.
And, the average bike that gets down there is probably worth between $50 and $100, some much, much more. People can pay $5 for that bike. Is it a struggle? Heck yeah, it's a struggle. But if you give it away, they abuse it, they don't mm-hmm. take care mm-hmm. of it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there was this young lady who came into the shop in Rivas, Nicaragua, totally in tears, crying. Carla finally got her settled down. She had graduated from teacher college. Mm-hmm. She was 17.
Aww.
Which, in Nicaragua, teacher college, that's the equivalent of maybe a poor high school diploma here. But the state of Nicaragua gave her a second grade classroom. So this was her one chance to be a professional woman to move ahead, and the classroom was 8 miles from her house. 17-year-old Nicaraguan girls don't move out into apartments. There's another name for that.
Yes.
You know, when she goes on a date, her mother goes with her.
Yeah.
This is old school.
Yeah.
And the girl couldn't accept the job. So Carla did give her a bike on the promise that she came back for the next 5 months and paid $1 for that bike. And she came back first of the month every time, paid that dollar, aww, paid off the $5 bike, and now she's a professional woman. And 8 miles on a bike, you can do that in 10, 15 minutes.
Easy.
It's not a big deal.
Yeah.
But without that bike, with no public transportation, there was no other way to get there.
That's incredible. I love the stories. I think it's amazing. Well, the other thing we should talk about is, yes, people want to bring you their bikes and bring you the sewing machine, but you also require them to give a $10 donation to help with all kinds of costs. So explain why that is, because I think it's a good idea.
A couple reasons. When you make an in-kind donation, and if you were audited, the government could accept or reject that donation. But if there's money attached to the in-kind donation, that donation is golden. Also, people should be responsible for their solid waste. It's your solid waste. On the other hand, we're a small NGO. We struggle. I'm going to take your bike or sewing machine. We're going to repair it. We're going to ship it halfway around the world and distribute it to someone that's going to change their life.
Yes.
Don't be cheap. Give me the $10.
I agree.
And in the beginning, we didn't ask for money. 30% of what we got was absolute junk, and it's hard to get rid of garbage.
Mm-hmm.
Since we started asking for a donation with the bike, and this is the fascinating thing, not only did our junk rate go from 30% to zero, but our overall production went up.
Oh, my gosh.
Because no one with a $1,000 bike was going to give it away. I paid $1,000. I'm not going to give it away. But I'm so happy to pay you $10 to take it. It's a crazy reverse psychology, but it's absolutely true. So I never got a $1,000 bike when we didn't ask for money. Now, last year, we got at least a half a dozen bikes that sold for over $3,000.
Oh, my gosh, incredible.
And we're not looking for rusty hunks. You know, we want to get the best bikes we can. And when we can get, you know, we got a couple of carbon fiber bikes that sold for $3,000, there are kids who want to go fast everywhere. There are racers everywhere.
I believe it.
And I used to fight it. We'd open up a bike shop, and there'd always be kids there like, I want to race. And it's like, that's not what we do. And in the end, they all became the bike mechanics in the shops, aww, and they still want to race. And the racers will come up with the money. So we try to get like 5 to 10% of the value of the bike. So if it's a $3,000 bike, yeah, I want $300 for that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And if I have four or five of those in a container and they can sell those to the racers in the country for $300 or $400 a piece, those five or six bikes can pay half the shipping cost of the whole container, which means the price of all the rest of the bikes can go way down, especially the kids' bikes, so we can be selling those for 10 cents, 25 cents a piece.
Oh, my gosh.
Because I move 30 tons of steel halfway around the world every year. There are expenses involved. I have gotten free shipping now and then. But when you're shipping every month, mm-hmm. they're not giving it. You know, you are now a customer, and you have to accept those shipping costs as
yeah.
part of the program.
That's business.
And honestly, we've been asking for $10 per bike since 1995.
It's time for a raise.
I would love to raise it to 20 because our actual collection cost is $20 a bike.
Wow.
Just getting it back to the warehouse ready to ship, it's $20 a piece. And then there's the shipping cost, you know, each container of 500 bikes, you know, $6,000-$7,000. You know,
yeah.
there's another $15 in shipping cost.
Yeah.
So we get $10 from the owner.
Okay.
And then we try to get $10 from the recipient.
Okay.
And then that still leaves me $25 or so that I have to go begging and groveling to find.
Well, you know what you should do? So you should up to 20. So and do it gradually. So we're in 2018 right now. So do it gradually and say, right now we're still at the 10, but we're suggesting 20. And by 2020, it's going to be 20. Like, we'll do
all
something
of,
like that.
All of the groups, because we don't collect bikes.
Right.
We have groups
yeah.
around. In Flemington, it's the Flemington Rotary Club and the Presbyterian Church. I wrote to all of the groups that collect bikes for us, and they absolutely refused to raise the amount.
Really?
Yeah. They just felt it was too much, and they said that if I raised the amount, they would just stop
really?
Collecting. So I'm kind of stuck at 10, and it's easier being a round number than an odd number. You know, to go to 12 would be a lot more complicated.
Yeah,
I'd need change and stuff.
All right, well.
So I'm kind of stuck with the 10, but it means I just do a little more fundraising.
All right, well, I'll help you with the 20 campaign. I'm in. I'm hooked. Well, the other thing, you have a very lean staff. There's, what, four people? Like, it's not like you've got, you know, or board members or I guess you've got some board members and then you've got your basic core staff.
Yeah,
so it's not like you're a giant organization. You're lean, mean, right? Lean and mean bicycle machine.
Not by choice, but by necessity.
Well, I did get one quote from the website. It said, this is among the most responsible with the donor's money, which is always a good thing. So people can feel good about it's going to a good cause. You're doing good things. You're helping the environment by keeping the landfills clear of bikes and sewing machines. And also you're teaching skills, valuable skills to people for helping the bikes, breaking down the bikes, fixing the bikes.
On both sides of
yes,
the ocean. Yes,
it's incredible. So, the other thing I want to go back to also is, so what if we do have a young person that, I know in our high school, I've said this before, the sophomores are required to do 25 hours of community service with one organization. So if one kid or a couple kids wanted to organize a bike collection for you, how would they go about that?
They have to send an email to Lori at the office.
Okay.
Lori at p4p.org. We are in the midst of planning our spring collections, and it's a renewable product.
Mm-hmm.
I've been doing a collection in Flemington for 28 years. I get a truckload every year because people buy bikes. Now, in the recession, it got a little tough in the recession. People stopped buying bikes for a while because when we get a bike is when someone buys a new one, we get the old one.
Yeah.
And our production through 2011 into 2012 was going down just because of what was happening with the economy.
Mm-hmm.
But with what's happening in the economy now, our production is just surging again. And if someone wanted to be involved, we try to run as many bike collections as we can.
Mm-hmm.
We do two every Saturday. We do them every Sunday in the spring and fall. We're limited to the spring and fall. Once you get past November, people are busy.
Mm-hmm.
It's an outdoor activity. It's just too cold.
The holidays and all that
stuff. I've been in the snow dropping an axle nut in the snow and picking it out, and my fingers freezing. It's just we just don't get the volume to make it worthwhile.
Makes sense, yeah.
So we start the beginning of April and we go through June. And likewise in the summer, in July and August, they're at the shore.
Yeah,
I mean, nobody,
fun, yeah.
You know.
They're riding their bikes down the shore.
Yeah. So we do April through June and then September through November. So we have a limited season of collecting, but we're very, very active every weekend, and then we have pickups during the week, and we're spread now. We've shrunk our footprint, but we're still spread over. We do five states.
Nice.
Connecticut, New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and Delaware.
Okay. And then you've got a big one coming up next month, right? The you've got one at a bike shop in Hackettstown, big collection.
Oh, I don't.
You just run the place.
I don't do the collections anymore.
Oh, you don't?
My body's too beat up. No, my vice president, Gary, goes out to the collections.
Okay, Blairstown. Blairstown Bike Collection.
Yep, Blairstown, yeah.
And then you're doing, then the very next day in Washington, which is closer to here, I think, something with the chess club. So
that's the Warren Hills High School Chess Club, yes.
Nice.
And not only do they do a collection every year, but when we load containers, they come down and help me load the containers.
Young, strapping kids, right? There you go.
You know, it's a young man's sport.
I know, but that's perfect. So, oh my gosh, well, that's great. So if you're a high school student or a family, this could be a family affair, right? I mean, all kinds. I know you don't want little toddlers running around there, but if you've got kids in middle school or high school, they could get involved in this very easily.
Our collection in Ramsey is a family. It's
really?
A family that this is their family thing they do.
Aww, I love
and,
that.
And it doesn't – what we need for a bike collection is we need to agree on a date, time, and place. And we produce all the posters, all the news releases, and we give them to you. Mm-hmm. And then you have to put them up in your area because, yes, for the Clinton collection, I can help put up posters. But for the Hartford, Connecticut collection, I can't be up. I don't know where to put the posters.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. Yeah. But I think it's such a good engaging because you know you've got the basics laid out, but then it requires you as a kid or as a person to go out into the community and talk to people and get the word out, and it's good skill building, I think.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
It is. And then the one of the reasons that we've been successful is what we ask people here to do. It's one day, 3 hours, once a year. It's short and sweet. It's just Saturday the 24th from 12 to 3, you know, and then it's over, and you've done it.
And you feel good about it.
And feel good about it. And we average, pretty close to 60 bikes per collection. But we've had kids at middle schools, you know, really get out and get the word out and collect 300 bikes in 3 hours. I
mean, well, with kids and with Snapchat and everything today, if it's cool for one kid, then it goes
viral.
Yes, exactly. That's right. And we're back with David Schweidenbach of Pedals for Progress. And he said it a little bit before, but it's p4p.org if you want to check it out. They've got an amazing website with all the information about if you want to host a bike spring bike collection, if you want to donate, if you want to see some of the stories about the bikes and what they do and how they ship them. And the other section on there that I was very excited to explore was all the amazing awards that you've gotten. And I know you're a humble person and you're not tooting your own horn, but exposure is good. And especially if it's a good award like the CNN Hero Award. Can you tell how you got nominated for that and how you found out and how that all went down?
The CNN Award? Oh, that was a late one. I don't even remember who nominated me. Somebody nominated me.
Yeah.
The first award I got from the Peace Corps. Or from the Return Peace Corps organization. And it's the Sergeant Shriver Award for International Humanitarian Service. And, you know, my chairman of the board at that time nominated me for that award. And we did it for the money. What? That when you win an award, they give you money. One of the jobs that I do that I absolutely hate is I need to raise $250,000 every year.
Wow.
Because I have to pay the bills.
Big chunk of change.
And if you win an award, they give you a big check. So in the old days, we used to get a lot of big grants from Chase Manhattan, from AIG Insurance, from Johnson & Johnson. None of those companies give grants anymore. What they do is match employee donations. Mm-hmm. So our corporate foundation line item went from being the first or second down to being like the eighth line item. And we just don't get money from foundations don't give away money anymore. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we needed to find a way to raise money. And the biggest one, I became a Rolex laureate. that Rolex picks the five most enterprising people in the world every 2 years.
In the world? Wow.
And when I won in 2000, I got a check for $75,000. And that kind of paid all the extra bills. Oh, I milked that for about 8 years.
Good for you.
And some of these, and also, when you can win an award, you get on the radio, you get on TV. part of my real challenge has been building the name recognition.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what is Pedals for Progress? Mm-hmm. What is Sewing Peace? And
mm-hmm.
I never heard of that before. What do you do? And to get in front of people, to get out there, so that more people will know about us and might become donors, but also people will learn about us and decide they want to help and help us collect more bikes.
Mm-hmm. I think it's great. You know, just you can't do enough PR, especially today. You know, it's all good PR, good words, good association, and things like that. So you mentioned earlier that your wife wasn't too happy about all these bikes in your backyard, and but she was helpful. What about the kids? Like, what did they say when you were doing all this crazy bike collection when they were growing up?
When my son was very young, he helped.
Mm-hmm.
But then when he got into high school, his line was, I don't do bikes anymore. But he was really good at helping me find other high school kids who could help with the loadings. Because the loadings are, we move 10,000 pounds in 4 hours.
Wow.
I mean, it's...
Yeah, again, you need those young bucks to move that stuff,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, so in my last loading a week ago, I shipped 462 bikes to Cameroon and 28 sewing machines. I had two students from Warren Hills High School in Washington. I had one student from Voorhees, and I had two students from North Hunterdon.
That's it?
Who came. Yeah, it's usually a crew of five or a crew of six.
Okay, and that'll do it?
More people, you just... are falling over each other.
Oh, okay.
Because
so
the containers are kind of small.
Oh, so you've got a system.
Yeah, we got a system that we, because each shipment is a one price. It doesn't matter if it's empty or full. So the more we fit in, the more we can lower our per unit cost.
Okay, so you, at the site, the collection site, do you break the bikes down right there?
Yeah. If you've ever put three bikes in the back of a car, you know why we do it. The pedals go through the spokes. They're impossible. So at the collection, we disassemble the bikes. We take off the pedals and tie them to the frame. It's a special tool and a trick. It takes like 30 seconds.
Okay, good.
If you have the tool and you know the trick.
Mm-hmm.
And then we turn the handlebars sideways and down. So we compact the bikes so we have flat packages that roll.
Nice.
And then we can put them in the truck and get them, because we got to put them in the truck and then put them in the warehouse, and then we got to take them out of the warehouse and put them in the shipping container.
Mm-hmm.
And the closer we can fit them together, the more we can put in
right.
any one space.
Right. And so then on the other end, when they unpack them, do they have the tool and the trick at that end too, and they just start assembling them and figure it out?
Yeah. At the other, you got to remember that the bicycle is a product of the 18th century. And I've had groups all the time say, oh, you have to send someone here to train us. And I said, no, I don't. I said, put an ad in the paper. I'm looking for a mechanic. And eight guys show up with their tools because they're looking for work. They, you know, these are places that are underemployed. And there are people in every developing world country who can fix a basic bike.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the newer, very special ones, not so much, but a bike is a pretty simple mechanism.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, well, and if you've got someone who's just remotely mechanically inclined, I am not. But,
yeah.
I mean, but nor fortunately,
am I.
Really?
No.
Oh my gosh! Well, you're brilliant in many other ways. And then a minute ago you talked about Rotary and Rotarians. I love the saying "service above self." Like, there's so many generous Rotarians, and they all do so many great things. And I think I read that 35% of your bikes come from Rotarians or Rotarian groups.
Originally, it was closer to 100%.
Wow!
But
well,
more people getting involved.
Yeah, that's good.
When I go out and I do speeches, and I go out and do a lot of speeches because I want people to know we exist, I talk about economic development. I talk about business and Rotary. This is their bread and butter.
Mm-hmm.
They understand it.
Mm-hmm.
And every Rotary Club is required by rule to do two international projects per year.
Wow.
Well, they live here. What
yeah.
they don't know what to do.
Yeah.
And Pedals for Progress became a tremendous alternative for them, that this is something they could do at home, help their community, work with their kids,
mm-hmm.
but fulfill that international requirement. And, you know, Rotarians want to see a change in the world. Mm-hmm. Rotarians are out there working to make life better for everybody. Mm-hmm. It's a wonderful organization. Mm-hmm. And I kind of built the whole organization in the beginning through Rotary.
Yeah, that's great. Well, they are amazing, and I've met. They have an exchange program for kids for colleges, and they've been around for 100 years. I mean, if you haven't heard of Rotary, then you're living under a rock, or you need to learn more about it because it's incredible. And they are the service mecca. I mean, I think they do so many great things for communities in a good way. All right. Well, what else we got on that? You don't do an annual gala or any of those big kind of things, or what's your big ticket other than the awards? What's your big ticket fundraising hoopla?
producing my newsletter.
Oh, okay.
And we produce a newsletter twice a year. And what you do is you produce a newsletter, you send it out, you wait 2 weeks, and no solicitation to newsletter, just good news.
Mm-hmm.
And then you wait 2 weeks and you send a 1-page letter asking for all your money and your firstborn child. And individual donations is our largest line item.
Okay, good.
And the funding, it's a struggle. I mean, what limits my shipping is the amount of funding I raise.
Okay. Well, I mean, there's different ways there's all kinds of webinars and things to, I think people should just give. We just need to get more people to give because $10, well, okay, so you said you collect $10 for the bike. What would $10 buy in Nicaragua? Like if someone was handed a $10 American bill, would they freak out like they won the lottery?
No, but boy, you could get a really nice dinner and a couple of beers. I mean, if you're buying Nicaraguan things, $10 goes a long way.
Yeah.
But if you're buying anything imported, it doesn't go that far.
Yeah. No, but I just feel like we're just, a lot of people are just so insulated. They just don't understand how good we have it. I mean, everybody wants to come here for a reason because if you work hard, you can really make something of yourself. And people are working hard all over the world and they just want to eat and raise a family and get educated and, right?
Have a good life. Yeah.
Yes.
Not many people travel to third world countries.
Correct.
You know, a lot of the countries I work in, people say, oh, you get to travel to these countries? And it's kind of like, unfortunately. some of them are not very nice places, but those are the places where I work. Those are the places that need the help.
Yes.
Are some very desperately poor places. So, most people, unless they see a special on TV or something, really have no conception of what it's like to live walking everywhere you go all the time. It's a startling experience when it happens to you.
Yes. Well, I think you've done a tremendous job of enlightening many of us today on what that all means, what you're doing to save the world, change the world. I've enjoyed it. I don't think we had enough time to talk about it, but unfortunately we're at the end of the show, so we'll have to have you back again.
I'd love to.
All right, thank you. Pedals for Progress, P, the number 4, P.org.